I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. That's right, I switched up the opening intro a bit. It seemed apropos, we're at the dawn of a new moment. This is, after all, our first post-election edition of Parallax Views, post-2020 U.S. election, I should say. And we have a new president-elect, it seems, in the form of Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and his supporters argue that the election is fraudulent. Joining us to unpack the 2020 presidential election in the United States of America is J.P. Satilli, the gumshoe journalist otherwise known as the News Vandal. If you've been listening to Parallax Views for a while, well, you know that JP has become something of a fixture on the program. And that is with good reason, as his analysis is always insightful. In this conversation, we discuss a number of topics, including the media, both mainstream and alternative, during the Trump presidency, and going forward into the post-Trump era. Do progressives have a shot at building their movement? And much, much more. On this edition of Parallax Views, it's our post-election analysis edition of the show with the News Vandal, J.P. Satilli. Welcome back to Parallax Views. The one and only J.P. Satilli. Listeners know him as the News Vandal, and we've got him on for our post-election special, and I thought, who better to have on than J.P.? J.P., how are you doing since the outcome of the election?
I must admit, I feel a little lighter. As I framed it online, as a journalist, I kind of feel like my time as a hostage has just come to an end. I'm not trying to make a political statement there. It's just that since he came down the escalator, the news cycle, I've been doing the rundown I've been doing it now 10 years. So I was doing it throughout almost all of Obama's presidency. And the 4.5 to 5 years of Donald Trump has seen the news cycle become an all-encompassing sort of baton death march that you could never get off of. And I am looking forward to the possibility that the news cycle will return, not maybe to normal, but will not be so dominated by Donald Trump's presence in every corner and aspect.
We're already seeing that today a little bit. I mean, today it's just been Alec Trebek and rest in peace, by the way. And Biden all day long.
Right. Right. And so if I get up at 3 and I don't have a whole news cycle altering set of tweets to deal with, in addition to me trying to get into things like, hey, there's a war happening in Ethiopia, or there's something going on with microplastics in the Arctic, or all the different stories that I try and pack into the rundown and want to get into the leads, but I can't get into the leads because Donald Trump is not only dominating the leads. There have been times, JG, where I could put a Trump-related story into every category, into the leads, politics and fleas, foreign entanglements, into Pandora's box cutter, into the media scrum, and the odds and ends are often been the only holdout. And sometimes I'm putting things in there about, you know, weird, you know, cult stuff about occult stuff about QAnon or whatever. I mean, he could dominate every aspect of the news cycle in every category. And so to have that potentially come to an end, I have to admit, has made me feel a little buoyant.
You know, this actually gets into an area that I don't want to blindside you, but if there was awards we could give out for the best journalists and pundits, other than yourself, of course, that got us through the Trump era, who would those be? Because I think a lot of times people get focused on, I think, the pundits and journalists who I'm not fond of. Like, there's journalists that I think people love to hate. Like, I'm not a big fan of Barry Weiss, especially since she's from Pittsburgh, and I know a little bit of her background. It was very privileged, and I think people love to hate the Barry Weisses of the world or the Bret Stephens, but a lot of times we forget about the journalists who've really done the really great hard work.
Well, there are two ways to go on that. There's the journalism, and then there's the opinioneering interface with journalism. And in terms of – I can't really talk about specific journalists necessarily, but I can say that over the Trump years, the most impressive news outlet to me has been USA Today. They have done – deep dive investigative reporting on police violence, on police use of dogs, on the environment, on the child separation policy. Amazing investigative reporting there. I think for the New York Times, the thing that really matters the most is the Trump taxes expose, which was just incredible reporting. I think, you know, as I look at the Times, I saw a lot of news analysis on the front page, and I think that that was a mistake. I think one of the mistakes of the Trump period has been the integration of analysis with news by major newspapers and news organizations, which I think has distorted and colored the impact of the hard facts and data that they could have just let do the talking often. And in terms of the interfaces place where journalism and opinioneering interfaced, I'll have a couple surprising ones, because there, we can talk about The Guardian and we can talk about Julian Borger. There are a lot of people out there who've done analysis. Patrick Coburn, who's always on a featured on Counterpunch. There are a lot of good people who've done really hard, biting, insightful analysis. But I've been, you know, I look at a lot of different news sources, and I think the two who I've found most interesting are All A Pundit on Hot Air. And if you don't know Hot Air has been for a while a right-leaning Republican, pro-Republican site, and was very hypercritical of Obama during those years. But All A Pundit is the one guy who has stood out on that website as a rational conservative critic of Donald Trump's policies and approach to governance. And it has been a really interesting, you know, he's not trying to sell you on the Democratic Party. And I think that's one of the things that makes his analysis refreshing. And I think Tim Miller over at The Bulwark has been both funny and biting in ways that a lot of people have not. But I think ultimately, JG, that the whole media environment is itself in a crisis, because the environment that we have, the massive increase in subscriptions that the New York Times got, the fact that Tucker Carlson pulled 7 million viewers for his Bobulinski interview on Hunter Biden's laptop. The fact that CNN, I'll give just some data points. Before Trump ran, came down the escalator, MSNBC was pulling about 383,000 viewers total day. 383,000. CNN was about 480, 490, and then Zucker took over, and I famously criticized them for the poop ship coverage. I don't know if you remember the cruise ship that had a massive norovirus outbreak, and the sewage started to overflow, and it had to be towed into harbor in southern Florida. And they basically did a constant coverage of that ship. They just kept the camera on it the whole entire time and talked about it. That was a desperate plea for ratings. And there was talk that MSNBC was going to have to do have a recalibration from their MSDNC model. CNN was struggling, and Fox News was pulling about 1.1 million per day, and that was when Bill O'Reilly was their flagship. After that, they were all collectively pulling in about 8 to 10 million viewers a day because of Donald Trump. And that's a huge revenue influx. And so there's sort of like a Donald Trump distortion field that has made analyzing the media and just about everything kind of problematic, because his impact has been so gravitational. It's hard to know what's going to happen when that gravity center recedes.
I was going to say too, the only reason I mentioned some of those heavy hitters, I guess, that I'm not necessarily a big fan of, is I always hear people sort of picking, I guess, on the quote unquote mainstream media. But and I think there are people in the mainstream media that I don't think do top notch work. But there's people that write for the Washington Post that really did do good work. There's people that wrote for the New York Times throughout this whole 4-year period that did really good work.
Yeah.
People like Catherine Stewart, who I just had on, who's been covering the issue of Christian nationalism and its influence on politics. I feel like those journalists get overlooked a lot by the alternative media. And in some ways, I feel like the alternative media is almost becoming too much like the mainstream media in some ways. It's become less about analysis you're not going to get anywhere else and more about sort of team sports politics.
Yeah, and David Fahrenthold and Heather Long over at Washington Post, David Fahrenthold on Trump's financial dealings and Heather Long on the economy over there, doing great work. And this is one of the things that I notice about, you know, the Post and the Times in particular. I've mentioned USA Today, a overlooked newspaper, and really a lot of alternative media should have paid attention to the USA Today, because a lot of the issues that they care about, particularly on the progressive side of alternative media, because remember, we have two sides of the alternative media itself, because there's a whole right-wing alternative media landscape. But they've missed out on some incredible reporting on issues that they really care about, because there's just a tendency to write off the New York Times, the Washington Post, and particularly USA Today when they're kind of missing an opportunity to megaphone things that would megaphone the issues that they care about. So, and you know, when I look at the Times and the Post in particular, I think you have to separate the top line parts of like the New York Times, which is Thomas Friedman and David Brooks, and for a while, as you point out, Barry Weiss. This is not actually the reporting side of it. You know what I mean? These are the things that people like to talk about and moan about and troll people about on Twitter. And so that's part of that, I think, distortion field that Donald Trump has created in the United States, where opinioneering and news are indistinguishable. I mean, it's really what made, to me, MSNBC completely unwatchable halfway through Trump's presidency. I couldn't do it. And the thing that frustrated me the most during the last 4 years was the fact that the straight reporting, we went down, we gumshoed an issue, we talked to people, we got facts, we got different points of view, we put it all together in a well-crafted piece of actual enterprise journalism. Those things were missing, because everybody was reacting to the clickbaitable opinion piece, and particularly in cable news, it pushed out a lot of fact-based reporting that would have actually achieved the thing that the opinioneering wanted to achieve but couldn't achieve, because it didn't have anything other than the hot air and bluster of somebody trying to clickbait us into following them.
Do you think that, and I want to get into the election itself, but in terms of media, I mentioned the alternative media, which I think we need to be more open to criticism to now, because I think the promise of alternative media as the fifth estate that would replace a compromised fourth estate, I'm not sure that we're actually getting that. And, you know, I think people like Matt Taibbi have brought up good points about, for instance, the dominance of access journalism in the mainstream media. But I think the alternative media has sort of become, in certain regards, similar to the mainstream media in the way it operates at times. Does that make sense, or am I being too harsh?
I don't know. I mean, we're talking about a large category here, the alternative media. I mean, are we talking about Common Dreams, Democracy Now? Are we talking about In These Times? Are we talking, you know, I think one of the problems that we face, it's complicated because, you know, is there such a thing as a fully objective news source? And so then we start getting into sort of philosophical arguments and post-structuralism. And, you know, there's a point at which we can all become Hume and say, you know, we can't really prove anything. Ultimately, everything is just your experience. But, I think one of the things that's missing from alternative media often is the willingness to engage in enterprise journalism that the mainstream media is able to do so well because it has the resources to do it primarily, right? So I think there's like a treadmill effect in alternative media where you're always trying to garner an audience. I look at like Raw Story, right, as a good example of this. They're always trying to hold their audience and hold their audience and hold their audience. And in the process, they're not allocating funds towards trying to uncover a deep dive into an enterprise story, which is something that BuzzFeed has tried to do, but hasn't really been that successful in doing. I mean, Jason Leopold, he's doing a great job with his FOIA requests and uncovering a lot of different things. And they did have that Trump Tower story, which was a pretty good enterprise piece in Moscow. But
the same Jason Leopold, for folks that don't know, that broke the Enron story.
You know, right.
He should be a legend. If anyone doesn't know Jason, read his memoir, News Junkie. It's incredible.
Yeah. And did great work on the war on terror too, by the way, you know, being able to target FOIAs to get information. So, you know, I think that the muckraking enterprise journalist, which should be the avatar in my mind of an alternative media, so that what you're doing is you're forcing the mainstream media, if they're ignoring topic A, you put the resources into exposing topic A and forcing the mainstream media to respond to your expose of topic A and forcing them to basically mainstream the story that you enterprised. And I don't see a lot of that. I mean, in a way, there's like this thing in both alternative universes where the badge of honor is not to have the mainstream media pick up what you're doing, but to have the mainstream media ignore it to prove that you're right and the mainstream media is wrong.
Well, I think too that, you know, you can get crushed like a bug in some cases when it comes being the enterprising journalist. I immediately think of, you know, and people may disagree with me on this. I'm sure there's still mainstream types that would, but I think what was done to Gary Webb was completely unacceptable, to be honest.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
I think the corporate press went after him in a way that was really ridiculous. And I think a lot of it was actually due to personal jealousy more than anything else.
And you know what? That's actually one of the main drivers. You know, this is one of the – I'm so glad you brought that up, JG, because – I've worked in the mainstream media a bit, and you know, when I went into DC, one of my feelings was that the mainstream media, because of Gary Webb in no small part, I was highly motivated by the Gary Webb story in the 90s. And when I went to DC, I kind of carried that as a chip on my shoulder. And what I believed was that the sort of the mighty Wurlitzer idea of Bernstein, that everything is manipulated and controlled, and there's a secret agenda behind the media that's keeping the truth out. And one of the things that I've found was that, you know, the media is actually acting for much more callow and less complicated reasons than we think. professional jealousy is one of them. If you break a story that they didn't break or that they missed, that they may have missed badly and whiffed on badly, like Gary Webb was showing them. I mean, all they had to do was go back and look at John Kerry's attempt to try and uncover what was going on with drug dealing and the CIA and related to Iran-Contra, which then after Bush was elected, Herbert Walker Bush went away, and not surprisingly, because for obvious, maybe, or maybe not obvious reasons, but because I think Herbert Walker Bush had a fundamental knowledge of what was going on with Iran-Contra. But, they are responding to the fact that they got scooped. And instead of following on with the scoop as sort of the more utopian view that I presented earlier about enterprise journalism leading the way for mainstream and mainstreaming stories that they're ignoring, which may itself on my part be a sort of a fanciful delusion. Given my personal experience trying to mainstream the story of depleted uranium in Iraq, which didn't go well for me, that there's that professional jealousy, but a lot of it is really comes down to the bottom line, because news during the broadcast era and prior to the end of the Fairness Doctrine and then prior to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, news operations were designed to lose money. They were supposed to lose money. It was your way of showing the FCC that you were meeting your obligation to keep your share of the broadcast spectrum, that you were fulfilling your duties as a steward who was being given by the people access to bandwidth, and you had to do these things. So it was a acceptable loss. But throughout the 90s, it turned out that news and infotainment, as it became, was a great way of making money. Low overhead. You didn't have to hire actors or writers or anything. I mean, as OJ showed and Monica showed, all you have to do is get a bunch of people who are desperate to be on TV. And so you probably don't even have to pay them to come on and talk about what just came off of the AP wires. And you don't even have to have reporters around the world showing what's going on in Darfur or what's going on in villages in India or what's going on in the Aswan region. Anyway, you don't have to have.
I was going to add to that too. Not to interrupt you, but.
No, please.
I think that this is getting into maybe territory that's considered controversial, and it's a very class-based analysis. But I think journalism in a lot of ways has become, what George Carlin referred to as the big club. And I don't want to say this in that, like, Tucker Carlson, like, oh, ye cosmopolitan liberals destroying the little man. That's not what I mean, but. I think you look at a lot of journalists, whether it's Barry Weiss, who comes from, a background that really helped her out, or even someone like Matt Taibbi, who I tend to like. But I mean, Matt comes from a family that's very embedded in journalism, and I think that has probably given him a leg up on other people. I feel like journalism is sort of a big club, and certain people have a leg up on others. Maybe not even in a class-based way, but in a sort of social status way, or just knowing the right people, being in the right family. Does that make sense? And I think that has an effect.
It not only makes sense, I watched it firsthand. I experienced it. I went to D.C. I started out wanting to be a policy analyst, a defense policy analyst at the Center for Defense Information as a research assistant. I got sucked into TV and ended up at the NewsHour. And when I got to the NewsHour, it was run by something called the Medill Mafia. That's the Medill School of Journalism from communications, I think, is actually the term that they use, the word they use at Northwestern. And then what you encounter in the news media environment in DC are people who went to Medill or went to Columbia. And in television, I was constantly running into people who had a father who had been in network news, and that's how they got their start in television news. And they populated all the different networks at every different level.
It's funny you mention that, because I remember QAnon people were losing their minds over Anderson Cooper having a political science degree rather than, I guess, a degree in news media. And I said, you know, it doesn't have to be a big conspiracy, guys. It could just right. be that he's a Vanderbilt, and that That's really it. Helps you out.
Yeah, and if you know people in television or you know people who are adjacent to the news media, that's your way in. And a lot of people start. They start by being drivers for TV crews. And you work – you know, the other thing about the journalism industry is that it's very much like a vocation or a craft. It's like becoming a carpenter. You got to pay your dues. I had a master's degree, and I had to go get Jim Lehrer's coffee. And no matter where you come from, you have to pay your dues and work your way up. And there's a pecking order, and it's very much like becoming a journeyman in a carpenter's union. And it is a club, and particularly in D.C., this is where Taibbi is correct about access. It really is about your ability to gain access to people and the relationships you make and the clubbiness of DC in particular, where parties in Georgetown are where you interact with the people you cover. And I think that that's one of the delineation points. You know, it's one of the reasons why 20 years ago I decided if I was going to be in the media, I should not be a member of either party. I wasn't at the time, but not only should I not be a member of party, I probably shouldn't vote. And I think if you're covering politics as a journalist, your journalism should be your vote. That's your contribution to the political environment. You shouldn't have a dog in the fight or a stake in the game. And everybody does. And a lot of journalists have spouses who work in the political parties. Carl Cameron was a good example. He was covering at the time, I think it was the Romney campaign, and his wife worked for the Romney campaign, and he was at Fox News. So you start looking at those issues, and you go, God, you know, there's no line, there's no delineation. It's all enmeshed. There's great enmeshment there. But even with that, what I found more than anything in my time in the media and years of observing it, I believe this to be true, is that there really isn't a conspiracy to sell us a narrative so much as there's a conspiracy to make a lot of money. And the bottom line is ultimately the final editor of everything. And the main reason why you see the things you see, particularly in television news, is because that's what brings voters, that's a Freudian slip or not, brings viewers in. They're going to go with what sells, whether Zucker at that time when CNN was at a low ebb thought it was the poop ship. We'll just show this limping cruise ship with all these people who are sick and toilets that are overflowing, and we'll just go with the lowest common denominator. And I think ultimately, JG, I went to DC thinking that the people who run the news media are trying to shape the views of the American people. And then I came away thinking that what the American people are not only willing to watch, but eager to watch is shaping the views of the people who edit the news for them.
In regards to that, you know, I want to come back to the alternative media thing really briefly here. And I want to touch on the sort of, I don't know, maybe the darker side of alternative media, by which I mean websites like InfoWars or Zero Hedge. I'm not even sure that I would call them alternative media, because to me, alternative media is Counterpunch or Common Dreams. But what do you make of their role in the Trump era, and do you think they'll survive the post-Trump era?
It's such an interesting question. I'm watching this right now with Newsmax, which is making a play for Trump's Fox viewership. I mean, Christopher Ruddy is working hard, and they actually ran what looks to be a phony story saying that Judge Jean Pirro, her show was canceled this weekend because she had a conflict with the Fox brass over their coverage of Trump, because basically
I was going to mention in that regard, people are not noticing this as much, but they should be taking note of it. Fox News has been sort of throwing Trump under the bus very slyly for a while now. I mean, you know, there was that infamous incident a few months back where they cut Newt Gingrich off. They cut his feed,
yep,
because he started talking about Soros, and they were like, we're not dealing with this.
Yep. Yep. And throughout this process here, this election process, they called Arizona and they stuck with it, even though it became a problem. I mean, I think that this is not just the journalism side exerting itself over the opinion side. I do think that there's a calculation that they need to recalibrate themselves back to becoming a more moderate right-wing version of cable news, as opposed to a fully Trumpian version of cable news, because I think they see in Biden's election that there's a center-right opportunity for them to preserve their audience going forward. And plus, they can transition from Hannity, who is already being eclipsed by Tucker Carlson, to a Tucker Carlson anchored network. And Tucker Carlson has, over the course of the last couple of years, been willing to point out where he thinks Donald Trump has shortcomings, and even say that Elizabeth Warren is right about her form of economic populism. So it's there, you know, this is the thing. These, you know, people who make a lot of money off of the media, it's not that they say, I have this now, you know, I mean, there is obviously a right wing bent to Fox News that has led people down a number of paths. But by the same token, they do a lot of research, because it's integrated with the deep levels of research that go into creating advertising, to try and find the largest number of people that they can hold on a consistent basis, so they can charge the most money they possibly can for the advertising they integrate into the programming. So, you know, I see this modulation happening. And so I have DirecTV, and DirecTV has a quad screen that they have for news programming. And during the election, they replaced out, usually the quad screen was CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and the Weather Channel. It used to be Fox and BBC World, which I loved, because I really dig BBC World, because they actually take reporters and put them in places around the world, and they do actual reporting on what's happening in places around the world. It's kind of nice to see what's going on in Yemen when there's a bomb dropped or whatever. So not nice to see, but I want to have that access, which you don't get on an American programming. But that was replaced by Newsmax TV. Obviously, two things happened. One, they wanted to balance out the two for two. So it's CNN and MSNBC on the left and Fox and Newsmax on the right. I also think that Newsmax may have paid to be in that spot, because Newsmax, after being launched a few, like 5 or 6 months ago, I think, they were pulling like 30,000 viewers at one point. I mean, nobody's watching it. And so they may have paid for that placement handsomely. And Christopher Ruddy, who is a top Trump advisor, a non-official advisor, is the head of Newsmax and Newsmax TV. So they've been making this play. And I think that Newsmax is becoming sort of the island of misfit toys for Trumpsters, who are probably going to see their opportunities on Fox News decline, and they can migrate over to Newsmax. But throughout this process, as they yesterday evening, as I posted online, they touted that they're the only major news organization to not declare not declare Biden the winner. They're touting that on a chyron, on a lower third graphic, which is just, it's like, major? I don't know that you're major, but though fine, you do you. At the same time, Fox.
I mean, don't you think that I wanted to mention this real quick.
Yeah.
A lot of people are saying, well, the mainstream media is declaring Trump the winner and blah, 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 or not Trump, Biden. Sorry, yeah. Scrambled brains from this long week.
Look, we're all in this foxhole together, JG.
right. But what I was going to get at is, I actually think the media was almost excessively careful.
Oh, yes.
Because even like yesterday, and even a little bit today, I was seeing, Biden is the projected winner.
Yeah.
They do add the caveats in it. It's not as.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
And I've been crunching the numbers along the way. AP and Fox News are basically right. I think Arizona could be called, but I think because Arizona became a part of Trump's grievance that they're being extra careful, like you say. I think they've been extra careful with Pennsylvania when it was pretty obvious when, you know, Philadelphia is going nine out of 10 votes for Trump and there's 100,000 left and the movement's already in that direction that the election is over. Those are projections. In previous years, the networks used to project on exit polling prior to the 2000 election. This is one of the funny things about the 2000 election is that the exit polling is one of the reasons why the networks initially called for Gore. And then it was retracted, and then it went to Bush, and then it was retracted again. And I remember all of the hand-wringing after 2000. Exit polling, it's got to end. It's got to end. We can't do exit polling anymore. Even though exit polling had allowed networks to call elections quite early for 20 years, it was suddenly jettisoned. Now, I thought that was a nefarious move because what it showed was that the exit polling showed that Gore won, and in fact, he did win. And by getting rid of that type, now we do exit polling. It still happens, but it's actually on issues. And if you voted for X, did you vote for X because of Y or because of Z? That kind of exit polling happens, but the kind where who did you vote for and we're going to make projections based on that died after 2000, which was I think a convenient death for anybody who in the future would like to possibly manipulate an election outcome. And the exit polling was one way to tell whether there was manipulation because the exit polling and the actual polling wouldn't match, which is how they used to project. So now we're in this hyper careful moment, which, you know what, maybe is not so bad because I think there's an argument to be made that one of the reasons why these fraudulent claims about fraud are being exposed as fraudulent is because Donald Trump telegraphed what he was going to do to challenge the election. And if you look at Pennsylvania, there's Philadelphia, the convention center. There's been a camera on 24 hours a day, nonstop, showing what's going on. And that's a great way of undercutting the claims against you. So, and maybe, you know, we can fault the networks for not declaring earlier, but the fact that they didn't, maybe it gave space for this stuff to grow a little bit, for Rudy Giuliani to go to a weird landscaping business between a crematorium and a sex shop and have one of the most epic fails in his career and maybe in American politics in terms of trying to make a case of fraud. That's the Four Seasons landscaping debacle. If you're not familiar with it, the Philadelphia Inquirer today had an amazing story on it, today being Sunday. So to Google that, it's a load of laughs. It's kind of sad on some levels, but that careful approach, as much as maybe we want to criticize it, maybe it's the only way to go. It's the only option given the environment because Donald Trump's distortion field has so altered and colored the way everything is viewed that you have to have every I dotted and every T crossed. And I think the Donald Trump distortion field, if you want to pivot, I think is also why it's dangerous to try and make an analysis about what it is the American people said about anything other than Donald Trump in this election.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to get into that because I caught a lot of flack on social media the other day because I felt the need because I'm always someone that's trying to push back against, you know, prevailing optimism in some ways.
Sure.
But I said, you know, I have no hosannas for Perea's victories. And for me, I mean, just – this is only for me. But, I mean, the Democratic Party is already sort of signaling that it wants to go in a more quote-unquote law and order direction. James Carville is complaining about how defund the police cost votes. And, you know, I don't know what to think of that. Maybe they're right. Maybe America just doesn't like progressivism. I don't know, but I'm not very triumphalist right now. I mean, for me, it was about voting against Trump, not because I was enthusiastic about Biden. But I'm just not sure that this is all over is what I'm getting at. I don't think it's over. I don't think, the Trump era, what it has wrought is not going away anytime soon. And I think people like Thomas Frank have been pointing this out, in op-eds, since, you know, it became clear that Biden is the projected winner. But I just don't feel like we should be resting on our laurels thinking, oh, you know, everything's going to go back to normal. And maybe, you know, folks aren't actually thinking that and they're just celebrating because they beat the Orange Menace. But I get worried sometimes at what seems like triumphalism.
Well, yeah, I've spent a lot of time trying to parse. There's the Latino question. Why did he get this many Latino votes? And why is he doing so well with X? And why did this happen and that happen? And I've had a couple principles. For 2 years, I've said there's only one person who can beat Donald Trump, and that's Donald Trump. In other words, there's one name on the ballot. And the trick is to make the contrast between Donald Trump and normality or sanity or whatnot. It's not it, because you want to highlight Donald Trump as the central issue of the campaign. And that's what I think the campaign was. It was a referendum on him. And that's it. And so that distortion field, I think, makes it really difficult to infer the political and policy objectives of the American electorate, because that distortion field governed everything. So I think the presidential campaign is actually a beauty contest. It's a popularity contest. It's a reality show. Donald Trump was just voted off the island. Or for people who know or are familiar with me, I called the last year Coronavirus Apprentice, when he would come out and give his press conferences. I called it Coronavirus Apprentice. And the first thing I said was Coronavirus Apprentice has been canceled. I framed the election as, is this going to be a series finale or a season finale? Well, it was a series finale. And I think that the policy decisions are going to be made in the off-year election at the congressional level, when Donald Trump is not at the top of the ballot, to create this distortion field. Because, you know, Gigi, we don't know what's going to happen in 2022 when Donald Trump is not there to do something he did quite amazingly, which was actually pull new voters into his movement. He brought in new voters. He brought a lot of people out. Now, are those people going to be motivated to go out and vote in the off-year elections when the issue may be specifically healthcare and maybe Green New Deal or environment? I'm skeptical of that. So,
well, I mean, it's weird even looking at Florida, right? Because, I mean, Trump won Florida, but at the same time, progressives were celebrating because, oh, $15 minimum wage.
That's right.
That's right.
And then you've had drug legalization initiatives all over the country, although that's not necessarily a progressive thing, because there's a libertarian conservative argument that's at play there as well. So this is why it's so hard, because this country is now so big and it is so diverse and is so regional, and there's such a divide between urban and rural and suburbs and exoburbs. And we have all of these different factors at play. The one thing that cut across everything was Donald Trump. Do you want to listen to this man harangue you for the next 4 years? And to me, what Biden was the most vanilla off-ramp that you could offer to people. And the one data set that has stood out to me is that Biden pulled 5% approximately more white men than Hillary Clinton. So that's the Project Lincoln, you know, Philadelphia suburbs. And I watched the entire Pennsylvania race very closely on a county by county basis. And you could see where there were counties that on the same day voting were red, actually went to light red to light blue to blue. And
do you think the Lincoln Project played a role in this election? Because I know a lot of people have been saying, well, Trump's support amongst Republicans went from 90% in 2016 to 93%. It sounds like you're saying that it's more complicated than that. And
I think it's more complicated just because it allowed independents. It's not really about Republicans. It was about those independent men, the independents who took a chance on Donald Trump, and they didn't this time. And then you put that together, you marry that with, I saw an NBC report showing that there's a huge spike in voting in areas with colleges, that in Wisconsin, that in particular, and in around Ann Arbor and Detroit, those might have made a big difference because there was a big spike. So the thing that the Democrats have is they're actually piecing together this massive big tent coalition of all of these disparate voters who all were united by one thing. Let's just be done with him. And that being said, 70 million people said, no, let's keep going. So 70 million people said, no, let's keep going.
And this is with 66%, I think, turnout.
Yeah. So that tells you that he drove turnout up and got a ton of votes. The old idea that anytime you increase turnout, the Democrats win and the Republicans lose. That didn't happen in the House. Didn't happen in the House. Didn't happen in the Senate. So, you know, but then again, with the off-year election not coming, but also with this runoff in Georgia, I think the runoff in Georgia is going to be not about Donald Trump. It's going to be about one party's policies versus another. There's an acid test in a newly minted swing state, thanks in no small part to the efforts of Stacey Abrams and the backlash to now current Governor Kemp, essentially ripping that election off through voter suppression tactics. That's a laboratory experiment about – then you said it hasn't ended. This is where the next phase begins, which is, okay, now the country has said – We want to vote Donald Trump off the island. We're done with this show. We want to change the channel. So now the channel is changed, and now the focus comes, you know, is recalibrated to try and figure out what do we want to do with this now? Where do we want to go? Who do we want to support? I am not a Democrat who feels transgressed by the Democratic Party, because I've never been in the Democratic Party. I've never had expectations of them that I feel that Obama pissed away. I don't feel like I bought into Hope and Change and he sold me out, because I didn't vote in that election. I didn't vote for him.
That's not even the issue for me. The issue is, you know, when I have Democrats, who are more centrist, more like Clinton Democrats or whatever you want to call them, right, saying to me, well, you know, you're progressive, just vote how we tell you to, and we're not going to give you anything. And I find that very demoralizing, especially like right now. It's begun immediately. Like,
oh, yeah.
You have no place in the party is essentially what I'm being told. So I'm just very demoralized by that. I do think I'm always going to believe in progressive causes, but just seeing how quickly this turned into, you know, oh, you damn leftists, you're the reason we lost down ballot. I don't know what to make of anything anymore.
Well, and I think that assessment, either way, to say no, that didn't happen, which was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did in a very forceful interview with the New York Times, which was published today. So there's your mainstream media, right? Interviewing Ocasio-Cortez and getting a lay of the land, where she pushed back against that very strongly, pointing out that there were five candidates in swing districts that she and her operation helped campaign, and they were all reelected, as opposed to some of these others who maybe weren't. And then there's the Abigail Spamberger thing, which she's a former CIA agent who's in Virginia, who famously, you know, harangued everybody on the conference call. There's all that going on. I think all of those assessments need to be modulated with some humility, because the real issue of this election that we just have gone through is Donald Trump. It was about Donald Trump. That's it. End of story. Everything else has been has been altered by his presence on that ballot. Just like we began this conversation with how the news cycle has been altered by his presence on the ballot. We have just lived through a real life, real time reality show in which Zuckerberg and social media and the news media cast us all as extras in this insane reality show. And it was just canceled. I mean, there's a whole meta level thing happening here that parsing all of the data kind of misses, is that we just had the strangest Marshall McLuhan moment in history that had to happen because of our obsession with ourselves, our narcissism, which is reflected in our celebrity culture.
Well, it wasn't really about progressives versus centrists, in other words. It was about get this dude out of the White House.
That's it. One way I put it is I called this the tourniquet election. The body politic is bleeding out. Are we going to apply a tourniquet or not? Okay, we've applied the tourniquet. Now the body politic is not going to bleed out, at least over the next year or two. Now comes the question. How do you revive the patient? And, you know, I mean, I have my feelings about that. I think there is a path. On the progressive issue, the way I look at the progressive movement inside the Democratic Party is very similar to the evangelical movement inside the Republican Party. The evangelical movement, which really got kickstarted by Richard Viguerie and his direct mail campaigning in the early 70s, although he may not be responsible for that, his partner may be. But anyway, he takes credit for it. And
Paul Viereck Richard Viguerie. Yeah. And you know what? Yeah. It's funny. Viguerie admitted to all this in a book. He said, to the extent that, you know, Hillary Clinton's vast right-wing conspiracy existed, it was me.
It was me. Yes. Yeah. So what the evangelicals did is continue to vote for Republicans and get disappointed and taken for granted over and over and over and over again. Even with the Bush religious initiative, when they had that office they opened up for, you know, interfacing between the government and religious organizations, and that crashed and burned circa 2006, they were disappointed with W. And this is a man who said, I invaded Iraq because I talked to my higher father, not my father, not Herbert Walker Bush, but my higher father. I mean, you know, he had everything, and even they felt, even with him, they felt that they had not gotten what they wanted. They played a long game where they, year after year after year, slowly elected people at the local and state level. They finally started to get people into Congress. They started to build a powerful voting bloc, and a voting bloc that eventually the Republicans could not live without. And they, in playing that long game, that 45, 50 year long game, they eventually got what? The most evangelically friendly president in the history of the country.
I mean, I was going to add to that. You know, I think what you're getting at is that, you know, building a movement is ultimately very, very, very hard work. And, yeah. You know, I take back what I said. I do think progressivism I thoroughly reject Carville's mentality of, you know, progressivism stands no chance at any point in the future with Americans. I reject that, but we don't have the same resources, people that are more openly to the left like myself, as big right-wing media outlets, right? So it's an uphill battle, but that's what the struggle is about, I guess.
Well, and here's an analysis from somebody who is not a declared progressive, who is not in the movement, who doesn't do the politics. This is just me as an analyst.
You're not necessarily like Eric Dreitzer or myself.
No. So, but I have a sense of how it can work. And I think the thing is you have a banquet of issues that progressives are pushing on. But look at how evangelicals did it. They had one issue. Abortion. They stuck with it. They hammered it. They kept with it. And it turned into a powerful political force inside the Republican Party. I think that there's one issue that if progressives focus on, it can lay the predicate for future success, and it's Keynesianism. And so to me, the one avenue for success, when I watched Donald Trump his first week, I've told this story perhaps even here before, after the, you know, the biggest crowd ever and everything, the first thing he did on that Monday is he brought in a bunch of steel workers and construction workers and union folks and said, we are going to have a major infrastructure program. We're going to put America back to work. We're going to rebuild the bridges. We're going to rebuild the roads and the airports, and we're going to put people to work. And at that moment, I said, damn, he might be able to pull this thing off. Of course, that never happened, because Donald Trump is actually not good at politics. Donald Trump is a TV star, and we've been living in a show. We haven't been living in a political administration. So I think that if progressives worked on infrastructure and had a Keynesian influx of capital into the demand side of the economy and started to have a material impact on people's lives, much like FDR did. Let me explain it this way. I am a student on military Keynesianism, or of military Keynesianism. I've spent a lot of time on it. I've written about it. I've thought about it. I've examined it. And why do we have the empire and the military industrial complex that we have? Is it because there's a secret cabal of people in a boardroom or in a country club somewhere plotting American empire, and they're imposing it on the American people? Or is it because the American people have a material interest in the perpetuation of empire? I think it's that. I think it's because the American people have a material interest in the perpetuation of what? Of the F-35 being built in multiple congressional districts around the country with good paying jobs, working in a factory, building missiles, building radar systems. How about all the military bases that are the anchor for economies around the country? Why is it that members of Congress, why is the one area of unanimity of bipartisanship in America is the defense budget? Because the people who vote for those members of Congress and for senators have a material interest in the perpetuation of the Keynesian influx of demand side economic stimulus into their lives. It's not that hard. I look at military Keynesianism in a way as a proof of concept for Keynesianism, because demand side economics works. So the way that you, and those people have been a reliable voting bloc since Eisenhower warned about the military industrial complex. They vote for their self-interest. So if you can find a way to take that Keynesian, military Keynesian model and maybe apply to, how about energy Keynesianism? How about an energy industrial complex where people have a vested interest in a dynamic, in a newly built dynamic energy infrastructure that turns the national grid into a de facto battery where you can move around energy sources from one place to another, and you can actually have the wind farms of Iowa and Texas on a rolling basis providing energy for places around the country. And so what do you need? You need to build wind farms, and you need to have people to manage those wind farm systems and union jobs for people installing and maintaining windmills. So
I wanted to add too. I think what you're saying is really important, because, you know, I've been telling people to focus on the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset Summit that's coming up in 2021, because it gets overlooked. But there is a faction of what's been called the transnational capitalist class, and there are factions of it. But there is a faction of it probably best represented by someone like Charles Schwab, who are willing to do FDR-style reforms. And they can be pressured to do that by progressives. In a way, you have to make strategic partnerships. Now, I'm not saying Schwab wants to do those reforms just simply out of the goodness of his heart.
No.
It could be because, like Keynes, he's afraid of the Plebeian uprising, right?
That's right.
But, you know, we can leverage that.
That's right. And this is where ideological purity can get in the way. You know what I mean? Everybody's criticized the evangelicals for letting the ends justify the means, but you want to know what? They got their ends. They got their ends. So if you want to get there, you may have to do something like come up with a compromise position with somebody like a Charles Schwab to achieve your end, whatever. And those means may be, you have to hold your nose a little bit. But the way I look at it, you know, there's been some talk in the financial press that Wall Street was kind of okay with Joe Biden, actually. And not just for the neoliberal democratic reasons, like he's another neoliberal Democrat. But I think that there's an acknowledgement that supply side financialized capitalism is a farce. It doesn't work. It would be dead right now if the Fed was not basically handing no interest chips to the gamblers in the financialized economy and saying, keep on betting. To me, the only thing that's keeping the economy going and Wall Street going is the fact that everybody has decided we're not going to sell, we're just going to buy.
Someone said to me recently that quantitative easing is sort of like MMT, modern monetary management, but for rich people.
That's it. It's exactly what it is. And so if you think about it, what is the one way you can find a soft landing out of this insane debt cycle? That's to do what? Reverse supply-side economics to demand-side economics. Put money in the hands of people who spend it, not people who sit on it and bet with it. Because all the money that's been earned in this, in terms of economic growth, in my mind, and in my analysis, the vast majority of it, particularly since the Great Crash of 2008, has been what? Has been hoarded by the supply side, the beneficiaries of supply side economics, and they just basically use it to gamble and create more money that they're all sitting on. They're not investing in the hard economy of things. Nobody's investing and saying, wow, you know what? I want to be at the verge of the new energy revolution. So I'm going to take this massive pile of capital that we've accumulated. And I'm going to start building a dynamic energy infrastructure in let's say Arizona to do proof of concept to see if we can have a new energy infrastructure that can run off of something other than fossil fuels. Nobody's going to do that. They're not going to do that. Not when you can basically say, well, I'm going to do sort of marginal trades on currencies and I don't have to invest in anything or build anything or take any risk. Because if the pound falls 10 bucks or 10% against the dollar, I can make X amount of money. Why not do that instead of investing in building something? Who wants to do that?
The thing is too, I mean, people make a lot out of, you know, the reign of terror that has been sort of Reaganism, this sort of trickle down supply side economics, but you're already seeing the cracks in it where people are moving away from it. You even see it. I think that Trumpism arose in part because of people starting to reject it, because Trump, the language game he played in 2016 was not the same as Reaganism. I'm not saying he ended up delivering the goods on what he said he was going to deliver the goods on, but he messaged economic populism that wasn't in line with that sort of Reaganism.
Well, and if you want to say the sort of the beauty of Donald Trump is his ability to say one thing and do the exact opposite, which is why he was such an effective licensing operation for interests that wanted to make some money. He messaged himself as the anti-empire peace candidate and ended up selling more weapons around the world than anybody. So, you know, but then again, that's the military Keynesianism side. I think that this reversal of the neoliberal economic model, which starts with Milton Friedman, gets into supply side economics and then morphs into what we've called neoliberalism, which was really the Clintonian version of Reaganomics. That sort of culmination in the 2008 crash, which was the abject financialization of every aspect of the economy. And by the way, I actually think surveillance capitalism is just another aspect of financialization. We, the individuals who use it have been financialized. So, you know, there's the rationalization of everything that's going on. I think for the people who have benefited from supply side economics and financialization, I think that they see that the one soft landing possibility is to stoke demand side and have people start buying things. And if people start buying things, you kind of make things and let the people actually, through a more democratic, if you want to put it, version of capitalism, which is to allow the demand side to set the pace of what the economy is going to provide. Now, the problem with that is that you never can predict what the people are going to want to buy. They may want to buy bigger and bigger gas guzzling SUVs. That's, you know, one of the risks you take in that kind of environment. But ultimately, to have the people who spend the money and who need the money have the money and be able to infuse it in the economy. If you want to do things like restart or jumpstart the hospitality sector and things like restaurants, pay people more money. Give them an opportunity, $15 minimum wage. Give them a $26 an hour job building new energy infrastructure. They're actually going to turn around and spend that. And that's actually one of the things that happened to build the middle class in the first place. It was not just the Keynesianism of FDR, but it was the Keynesianism of the military-industrial complex that set a floor of earnings and income in 1950s America that had a cascading effect of building the rest of the economy. I think the challenge is to find a way to pivot out of military Keynesianism into less militaristic Keynesianism. By the way, Keynes hated military Keynesianism.
So I've kept you over as usual. There was just one thread I wanted to touch upon real briefly if we could.
Sure.
And it segues into – you actually provided a good segue for it in that you mentioned how Reaganism actually ended up sort of pushing Clintonism to the right in regards to neoliberalism. There's a lot of talk lately about how – the defeat of Donald Trump, we've defeated the white supremacist racist menace. I'm actually not as sure of that. And you're going to think I'm absolutely bonkers and crazy for saying this. But I told people yesterday, I said, you know, in some ways, the biggest winner, if the signaling of people like Carville or those within the Democratic Party leadership saying that they consider Nancy Pelosi too far to the left, which is bizarre to me. if those people are going to be the people running the party, in a way, the biggest winner of this election was someone who unexpectedly, apparently for many, he unexpectedly voted for Biden and Harris. And I'm talking about Richard Spencer, Mr. Alt-Right himself, because Richard Spencer's whole goal was to see that, you know, every sector of the political sphere, whether we're talking about the sort of actual left the right wing in America, conservatives, or just centrist Democrats, he all wanted to push them towards focusing more and more on just the working class. But what he means by working class is the white working class. And you already have the talk of the Democrats need to be a more law and order party to appeal to the voters. We need to focus more on the working class, which, like I said, I think when people say working class, they don't actually mean the whole of the working class. They're talking about white working class people. In a way, I think Richard Spencer almost called it right. It seems like certain elements of the Democratic Party do want to take the Democratic Party in a more right-wing direction. Maybe not in the same way as Trump, but you sort of see what I'm getting at. There's a little bit of concern there, and maybe it's just paranoia on my part.
So let me attack it this way by saying that it's about messaging. And when I look at, you know, Reagan and the impact that he had on the Democratic Party, which culminates in Clinton, who I've said repeatedly completed the Reagan Revolution economically, I look at one thing in particular, and it's not totally indicative, but I think it's important. It's an easy way of looking at it. One of the most important impacts of Reagan's election and the Reagan years was both him and the Republican messaging environment and messaging megaphones around him, the media influencers, was to turn the term liberal into an epithet. So to the extent to which by the end of the 80s, just being called a liberal in an ad was political death in parts of the country.
And to be fair, too, I mean, I was mentioning racism and white supremacy. You know, as much as Reagan is loved now by even centrists I talk to, oh, I wish we could have just had a Reagan figure instead of a Trump. I mean, there was tons of racist dog whistling with Reagan. I mean, welfare queens, right?
I mean, Philadelphia, Mississippi. I mean, it just went on and on and on. So, you know, that from there was a time when liberal was not an epithet prior to Reagan. And by the end of Reagan years, you were running away from the term liberal. That's what socialist is this time. Now you have to run away from the term socialist because you are afraid, you are cowed by the Republican messaging machine that has turned it into an epithet. I see that a complete parallel, a total echo of that. I mean, this is actually how Republicans have been doing it my entire lifetime, by the way. So you have this term that becomes toxic that your opponents can hang on you, and it's a messaging problem. And so I think that the Democrats, after Reagan, what they did is they said, oh my God, we have now got to change and alter ourselves to try and compete for Reagan's voters. The Republicans do a great job of making the Democrats, forcing them into trying to compete for their voters on their terms. I'll give you another messaging example. How about the term pro-life? And this is where what I would say about defund the police. Defund the police is actually a bonehead term to use to achieve your goals. It's just not the right term. It's a term that can be used against you. It's a scary term. How about instead of being anti-abortion, all of a sudden you call yourself pro-life? I'm pro-life. JG, aren't you pro-life? No, I'm anti-life. Nobody's going to say they're anti-life. You know what I mean? That's smart messaging.
I was going to mention the whole defund the police thing because my response to Carville's, oh, it's bad messaging and we need to move away from it was, and I see your point, but my thinking on it was, you know, for instance, in a place like Georgia, inordinate amounts of the taxpayers' money go to policing rather than something like public education, which, you know, a lot of poorer families in Georgia need. At the same time, your point's a little different from that because, you know, I don't think most people are going to think through why people would say defund the police the
that's
way
right.
I just did.
They don't. And that's, you know, this is something that it's one of my principles in life is do not use myself as a barometer to judge other people or particularly aggregate populations. What I understand and know is not necessarily the measuring stick by which we can assess what other people think and react to. You have to deal with the facts on the ground and the way people approach things. And defund the police. How about demilitarize the police? Oh, well, there's an interesting statement. Demilitarize the police. That's actually something that might have some impact, not just with progressives and maybe a couple moderates, but you want to know who's going to respond to that? A lot of libertarians. So there's a need. I think one of the things that happens, and this gets back to Hillary Clinton and the deplorables, is that by not doing your due diligence to understand the motivations of the people you are trying to either persuade or marginalize, you may have different, or maybe a combination of both. If you do not understand their motivations, you're not going to understand how to make your case one way or the other.
But doesn't that also apply maybe to, I mean, I still meet people here in PA that are like, you know, just in awe that there has been so much rage since the George Floyd protests, you know, the sort of NIMBY types, and they, yes, they do still exist. And there's no effort ever made on their part to sort of understand, well, what if the shoe was on the other foot? What if I put myself in this person's shoes? And I think it leads to people just getting angry and saying, yeah, you know, smash the police, abolish the police, you know, and they don't really care what these sort of NIMBYs think. And maybe it is a misstep, but I understand where the anger comes from.
Yeah, no, and I do too, because the level of injustice, the level of obvious injustice is so great that the only thing that seems like a resolution of it is to end it immediately. You know, it's not like, okay, well, let's end the war in Yemen, but let's slowly over time allow the Saudis to bomb less children. You know, if we can cut the number of children who die down by 50% in the next year, well, let's call that a success. That doesn't seem like a success. You know what I mean? There's a difficulty we face, and it's called the American people. And I hate to admit it, but I am pessimistic about the American people who, by my accounting, in the aggregate, tend to choose denial over truth and choose deferral of resolution to the easy way out. People don't really want to face a lot of the realities that are around. And it's one of the reasons why I think we ended up with Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump in many ways was the ultimate denial mechanism. Instead of admitting that our economic system had been exposed, that our imperial global system had been exposed, our economic system was exposed by what? By the 2008 crash. Our imperial military Keynesian-based system was exposed in Iraq and Afghanistan, but really in Iraq. And I think our hollow, systemically racist, and incompetent political system was exposed by Katrina. And after 8 years of Obama, and Obama was really more of like a life support system as opposed to a political solution, I think Donald Trump came along and said, no, we're great. And if it wasn't for all of the people who were selling you out at home and abroad, we would be a shining city on a hill. We would be just like Father Knows Best. We would be golden. We would be gods among men. America would be great.
The only thing I would add to what you're saying is that, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I think the issue is so deep-rooted that even our elections, I don't even know that our elections are about the American people, in the sense that, I'll put it this way, everyone always talks about, oh, the parties are so divided, but there's one thing that everyone from Trump to AOC always does in their messaging. They'll always mention the family unit.
Yeah.
You know, elections are really about the American homeowning middle class. And I know people argue that there isn't a middle class or it's fading away, but there is some type of middle class still. And that's who the elections are for. That's who it's designed for, in my view.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, it is different than it was in the 50s, but there's an element of truth in the idea that, you know, people say, oh, it's just the way we were. It was so great. We kind of never were that. I mean, it was kind of a fleeting moment, really, between kind of the middle of Truman to the middle of LBJ. I mean, that's the golden moment. I mean, it was the largest middle class, as such as it's been defined, in the history of mankind, occupying, you know, a big chunk of America. But a lot of people were left out of that. There was massive racial inequality. There was still Jim Crow. There was all these things going on that you could use as countervailing examples of how wonderful it was. But it's how people think about themselves that matter. And I think a lot of people still, even if they are just hanging on and a bill over $400 is going to crush them in any given month, they still want to think of themselves as the middle class. And really what a lot of elections are is about us making determinations about the identity we want to have of ourselves. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Trump's support is something that should be sobering for everybody, because that's an idea of how we want to think about ourselves that is incredibly entrenched in American life. And as you say, even across the aisle, if you want to say the 76 million who voted for Biden are on the other side of an issue, they're on the other side of the issue of whether or not we want to continue to watch Trump's television show. I don't know if they're on the other side of the issue of how we view ourselves as a people.
You know, and one of my exes said to me that they voted for Biden on the calculus that they wouldn't have to see him on TV as much as they saw Trump. So
yeah, I think that that's a that this. So let's wrap it up in a bow, because I think, again, you know, when I was thinking about the show, I was like, oh, I want to talk about what happened in Philadelphia and the exoburbs, and what happened in Monroe County, which I watched every, you know, 20 minutes. I kept, you know, and Erie County, where Donald Trump went and said, I wouldn't come here if I didn't have to, and how Erie County started out deep red and ended up blue, and all these interests. And over the course of the day, I've come back to something that has always informed my understanding of Donald Trump, which is we are living in a reality show. And this is a strangely meta level experience that we have gone through at a time when social media has turned us all into minor celebrities, and surveillance capitalism has turned us all into aspects of the very kind of system that I described earlier about the media and the mainstream media and cable news, and how Donald Trump came and rescued him and created ratings, and how we are all kind of involved in this strangely solipsistic televisual world. And really what we did is very simple. We fired Donald Trump. We voted him off the island, and we canceled Coronavirus Apprentice. That's what we did. And all of the other layers in this complicated melange of the United States are very hard to peel back when that distortion field is present, which is why the Georgia race and the off-year elections, I think, are going to be much more indicative of where we're going as a polity as opposed to where we're going as a reality show.
Well, let's leave it at that. JP, as always, thank you for coming on the show, providing a very insightful discussion, and for – we always end up going overtime. I swear to God.
Hey, JG, that's our cross to bear. I'm willing to do so, though.
Well, thank you very much, JP Satilli. How can my listeners check out the News Vandal?
Just go to newsvandal.com. Don't email me. I was going to give you my email address, but it's easier if you just go to newsvandal.com. The box will pop up. Sign up. You'll get a list of stories. I mentioned the categories earlier. You're going to see stories that you agree with and don't, but I stack the headlines so that all you have to do is read the headlines in order. I never change a headline. You can see the headline in the URL. Read them in order, and you will get the meta story of the news cycle, and click on the stories as you see fit. But I do it 5 days a week, and I've been doing so for 10 years, and hopefully it's useful.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed the post-election analysis of JP Satilli, the News Vandal. Be sure to check out his mailing list, The Rundown. It is an indispensable resource that collects the news of the day. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producers credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well then join those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews.
Also, a note to $5 and up Patreon supporters. I will be releasing a bit more content, some shows that I plan to have archived by the end of the month, as well as new editions of the Parallax Views current events program and general sort of chill session with my pal Casey the week that was. So all that and more over at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.